1 Corinthians chapter 4, I just want to read verse 1. And from the New American Standard, the New Testament writing of Paul says, "Let a man regard us in this manner, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God." Some translations say ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. But the word there in the Greek text is the word servant. Let a man regard us in this manner as the servants of Christ. It's been many years ago now that when we were living in California, and I went over to enroll in the California Theological Seminary. And after being in the office and getting all registered and all of that, I walked around a bit and went into kind of a little break area, maybe like a little student center area. It wasn't real large, but it was a place where teachers and students could meet, and they had, you know, some refreshments and machines and things like that in there. And I walked into the room, and there was a man standing there. He was dressed in khakis and a golf shirt with tennis shoes. And that when I walked in, he turned around, and I said, "Hi, how you doing? I'm Roger Daniel." He said, "Hi, nice to meet you, Roger. I'm Tim." I said, "Well, it's nice to meet you." And we talked for a little while. And you're a student here. "Well, that's great." And he said, "Nice to meet you. I got to go. And hope to see you again." And as he left, Winston Elliott came in. And Winston was a friend, someone I'd known for quite a while. He was one of the teachers at the seminary. He came in, and as they passed in the doorway there, he came to me. He said, "Hey, you get registered and everything?" I said, "Yeah." He said, I see that you met Dr. Powell." I said, "Dr. Powell?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "He introduced himself as Tim." He said, "Well, he would." I said, he's a doctor. He got a doctorate, right?" He said, "Well, actually, he has two." I said, "Oh, yeah, he has two earned PhDs from Fuller." This is no diploma mill, folks. Two earned PhDs, one in Old Testament and the other in Semitic language, as in Aramaic and Hebrew. I was impressed. Two PhDs from Fuller. Hebrew, Aramaic, I was impressed. But what impressed me more than his degrees is the fact that he never mentioned it. He just said, "Hi, I'm Tim." That impressed me. Paul said, "Regard us in this manner, servants of Christ." You actually find something of an evolution in this thing, or a progression, if you read the life of Paul. In the very early stages of his ministry, in the early writings of Paul, he refers to himself as an apostle. And that's okay, because he was an apostle. He was an apostle. But if you keep reading, you'll find that as the longer that he lives and the longer that he serves God and serves Christ, and the more he writes, he begins to change how he views himself. And so early on, he regards himself and he refers to himself as an apostle. And then later in his writings, he refers to himself as a servant. And then he regards himself as a fellow servant. And then he refers to himself as the least of all servants. And finally, he writes, as he does in 1 Corinthians 4 and 1, and refers to himself as a slave. And that's really what the word means. Now, that in a day of celebrity preachers, internationally known ministers, and TV stars, Paul's repeated reference to himself as a servant of the Lord sort of stands in stark contrast to the superstar image that seems to be so prevalent in Christianity today. Paul had no concern for titles or marquee buildings or spotlight. He understood that to be a minister in Christ's kingdom was to be a servant, a teaching that was clearly set forth by Jesus himself when his disciples were arguing among themselves as to who would be the greatest. And Jesus took a basin of water, removed his outer garments, girded himself with a towel, and knelt to wash their feet. And he said, "If I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you should wash one another's feet. For whoever will be greatest in the kingdom of God should be the servant of all. In the kingdom, that is the measure of greatness. Watchman Nee, he said, to have God do His own work in us, if only once, is greater than a lifetime of human striving and human achievement. I doubt the world that we live in today would agree with that. In fact, they would scoff. The idea of being a servant, they would probably mock that and ridicule that. But the fact of the matter is, Watchman Nee, in the same spirit with Christ and Paul, they are exactly right. Paul repeatedly referred to himself as a servant. Now, in the Greek language, there are seven different Greek words for the word servant. The most common is the word doulos. And then there's the word soon doulos, which means fellow servant, because that little word soon means with, and like serving together. And in this particular passage, in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, he uses a very unique word. In English, it's just translated servant. But in the Greek text, the word that he uses there is this word, huperetes. Now, I mention this because it's very important. It is the heart of the sermon. The message to you has to do with the meaning of this particular word, of what it communicated to. Who is he writing to? He is writing to the Corinthians. So what did they, how did they react when they heard this word, huperetes? I wouldn't expect you to know that yet. That's why, if you did, I wouldn't need to preach about this, but that's what we're going to look at. To them, this word, huperetes, communicated a vision of humility and absolute servitude. Because the word literally means under rower. Under rower. Huper, huperetes. Huper is the preposition for under, and the last part of that verb is the verb meaning to row, as in row a boat. Huperetes, the under rower. And to us, it may have little meaning, but to the Corinthians, it had huge meaning, and it was, in fact, something of a loathsome term. Corinth was one of the wealthiest and most prominent of all the Greek cities. It was located at the isthmus that joined the southern peninsula to mainland Greece. And one of the most common sights to the people of Corinth was the ship tramway that moved vessels overland to the opposite shore. You know, the Panama Canal was dug to keep people from having to go all the way around South America to get through. Well, in this area, to prevent them from having to go miles and miles and days out of the way, there was this overland. There wasn't a canal because there wasn't water, but they had an overland tramway that they took boats out of the water and transported them overland to the next body of water and then put them back in the water again. And this was a common sight because it saved time and days of travel for all who used it. And the most common vessel that they saw was a vessel that looked somewhat like this. The triremes, they were called. And you see, tri, that means three. And that's because, if you can see from this side, they had three levels of oarsmen. Now, it may not show up, you can see it there a little bit, but they were at three levels. And they were offset so that the oars didn't bang into each other. So the under rower was the person who was at the very bottom of the ship. And as you might know or guess, they were the galley slaves. This picture might be familiar to you because it's from the movie Ben-Hur, where Charlton Heston plays the role of Judah Ben-Hur. And at one point, falsely accused, he is sentenced to the galley ships. And this is a picture of them. You've seen this in the movies, and you know what I'm talking about. There may be hundreds of men that are chained to these oars, and they were called the under rowers. So with this background, we begin to gain some insight as to what Paul means when he reuses this term in referring to himself. You have to understand that there is no slave on earth lower than the under rower. This is the lowest that a person could possibly go. I mean, even among slaves, there were certain ranks. This is at the very bottom. This is the bottom of the barrel, so to speak. And so he uses this term, regard me as an under rower, a slave. Regard me in this way. And he gives us a vivid picture of what it means to really be the servant of Christ. So let's take a moment and take a look at what life is like at the bottom of the ship. There are five things I want you to consider from this morning. The first of these, that it was a permanent assignment. In fact, most of these triremes were no more than floating prison gangs, because usually the under rowers, the galley slaves, were prisoners who were sentenced for life. And most of them, listen, they would die in that ship with their hands on the oars. And for them, it was always a one-way trip. The damp, hard benches were no relief to the misery and of his body and the weary bones after days of labor. The lack of sunshine and fresh air, combined with leg chains that meant leg cramps and repeated illnesses, binding every slave to the ship with deadly certainty, were those chains. And if the ship went down in a storm or in a battle, slaves had no way of escape, and they went down with the ship. So when Paul refers to himself as an under rower, a huperetes, basically what he's saying is, I'm in this for life. This isn't an experiment that I sort of try for a little while and see if I like it and then decide. But he said, this is a lifelong commitment of my life to God. Not a temporary assignment. I'm not here on an interim basis. It was, in fact, a calling that would consume his whole life. Demas would forsake the way, enticed by the love of this world and its pleasures, and others would desert him and fall along the way. But Paul's testimony in the face of hardship, trials, threats, and tribulation was, none of these things move me, that I might finish my course with joy. And he did finish with joy. He never looked back. He came to the end of his life and he said, I fought a good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. He died in the Lord's service with his hands still on the plow, still in the harvest. It was a lifelong commitment. When Cortez, the Spanish explorer, landed on the American continent, when they came to discover and explore America, when his boats, his ships landed and they got on the beach, the first thing he did was he ordered his men to burn the ships. And it was a clear signal that there's no going back. There's no turning back. There's no running away. We are committed. We are here for the long haul. This is a lifelong commitment. For most of you, I think that you share that same kind of commitment. And I don't know about you, but I burned the ships behind me, because there's really nothing to go back to. And there's nothing back there that is worth the investment of my life, of my time, my talent, my energy, my treasure. There's nothing else that is deserving of a lifelong commitment except that which is given in servitude to Christ. And I have too many miles behind me, too many prayers that I have prayed, too many tears that I have shed. There's nothing to go back to, and I'm not going to turn around now. I'm in it for life. Amen. I'm in it for good. So it was a permanent assignment. Second thing you need to know about the huperetes was he had to row to the beat of the captain's drum. Now, there would be as many as 100 and 150 slaves in these galley ships with their hands on the oars. And to keep them together, the captain would beat, or have someone to beat, a rhythmic tempo on a drum. And if they wanted them to row faster, then they would move the tempo up to allegro, meaning faster. And then the slaves had to row with the beat. Now, the slaves didn't get to choose the beat. They just had to row to the drum of the captain. Are you getting the point? If there's anything I know about Paul, one thing for sure is he marched in time with the beat of heaven's drum. You know, yeah. You see, there was a day when Paul had his own future planned out. And he was working hard. He was climbing the ladder in Judaism, maybe with his goal to be the top Pharisee. And believe me, he was advancing, the Bible says, far above his countrymen in the ranks of the Pharisees, and was regarded, probably he was the rising star. But one day on the Damascus Road, he met Jesus. and his life was never again the same. Hallelujah. And you read about it in Philippians 3 when he lists his pedigree and talks about how he was born a Hebrew of the Hebrews and how he was of the tribe of Benjamin and how he was circumcised the eighth day and how he was of, you know, concerning the law that he was blameless and of the strictest sect of the Pharisees and on and on. He lists his Jewish pedigree. And then he says, I count all of this but as rubbish. All of it is trash compared to the excellency of the knowledge of Jesus Christ, for whom I've suffered the loss of all things, that I may gain Christ, that I may be found in Him and know Him in the fellowship of His sufferings. He turned his eyes on Jesus, looked full at His wonderful face, and the things of this world grew strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace. And then he tells the story. Before King Agrippa, it's in Acts chapter 26, verses 12 through 19. As he tells him what happens, I was advancing. I was, you know, I was on my way in the group, this sect of the Pharisees. And he talks about the light that shone and the voice that called him. And from heaven there came a call to his life. I've called you to send you to the Gentiles, to open the eyes of the blind. And here's his statement, King Agrippa, I have not been disobedient to the heavenly vision. He'd received a call from God, and that call dictated the course of his life. He, having heard that call, he listened to no other voice. Can I tell you that some of the reason why a lot of God's people don't live with intention and purpose is because you're listening to too many voices. There are too many influences in your life. The Lord has too many rivals for your affection and for your attention. And that's why your life is like a shotgun scattered everywhere instead of a rifle. And that was Paul. He said, this one thing I do. He lived by the principle of concentration. His life wasn't cluttered or confused with a lot of side issues. For him to live was Christ. Nothing less, nothing else, nothing more, and at any cost. The chief interest of his life, the absorbing passion of his heart, every thought of his mind, every step of his feet, every longing of his soul was for Jesus. Everything else was eclipsed by the greater glory of Christ. And there was no other influence in his life. He marched to the beat of a different drum to such a degree that he could say in Galatians 2:20, I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life I now live, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. Too many voices. Too many influences. Do you know that I'm told, I read this, I'll have to take their word for it, I'm not about to try it, but I'm told that the reason that lion tamers, when they go into the cage with the lions, they'll often take a stool. Not me, I'm taking a machine gun. The truth is, I'm not going in the cage, period. But one of the reasons that they do this, and I'm not sure how they know this, just maybe by observation, is that when they put the stool in the face of the lion, it usually has three legs on it, and the lion keeps looking from one to the next, and it breaks his concentration. He can't get focused. He's like this, and it gets his mind off of lunch. I don't know about you, but a lot of the stools we see today, they got a lot more than three legs, don't they? And every time you turn around, there's a being stuck in your face, and we can't get focused, and we can't get, you know, fixed on one thing and live by a sense of concentration because some of us, we got so many irons in the fire, we can't keep any of them hot. And I tell you what it's like. You like the guy on Ed Sullivan. Remember the guy that used to spin the plates? Had that little whip thing, and you know, he put the plate up there, and he'd flip it around, and he'd get that one, and he'd get another one up, and he'd get that one, he'd be looking back, watching this one, and then he'd run back over here, and he'd turn this one, he'd run back over here, and that's the way a lot of us live our lives. From morning till night, running, spinning the plates, till we're exhausted and weary and out of breath. And no matter how tired we are, we just keep adding to the schedule. We don't know how to say no. We don't know how to be stewards of our time. And that means making time for God, including give. You know, we talk about paying tithes. What if people gave 10% of their time every day to God? Wow, 2.4 hours. That would be significant, wouldn't it? What is it? Too many influences, too many voices. Just one voice. The Christian who truly walks with the Lord will always be a puzzle and mystery to this world because he is simply rowing to the beat of the captain's drum. Not following the influences of this world. People ask me, why'd you go to Yakima, Washington? I mean, I've lived in a lot of places. Born in Florida, lived in Alabama, moved to Washington, then the state of Iowa, the state of Nebraska, North Dakota, finally the state of California. So when Paul said, I've learned whatever state I'm in to be content, I understand that in a kind of a new and personal way. Why would you go way out to California? I heard the beat of a different drum. And after living there for 23 years, and people ask me, why are you moving back to Alabama? Heard the beat of a different drum. Why do you give to missions? Give your money to the missions. Why do you forgive people that have offended you or hurt you or done you wrong? Why do you take the excess change that they gave you at the grocery store, gave it back, and return it? Because you have a different set of values. You live by a different influence. You march to the beat of another drum. Let's look at the third thing here. The third thing is to trust the captain. In the gloomy, listen, I want you to think about this. In the bottom of that boat, he has no idea where the boat's going. Boy, have you ever been there? In the bottom of the boat, he has no idea where that boat is going. He doesn't know where it's going. He doesn't know, because he doesn't know where they're going, he doesn't know when it arrives. He doesn't know if they've ever arrived. It stops, maybe that's his clue. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't get to navigate the ship. All he gets to do is row. And if the captain's beat, the drum beat picks up, it could signal an enemy attack. Or maybe there's a storm. Or maybe they have a hurried schedule. But he had no way of knowing which. Because he's just a servant. He's not the captain of the ship. Life is a lot easier if you can resign as general manager of the universe. If you can take your hands off of it and surrender control to the captain. Now, you won't do that if you don't trust him. Do you find it strange, more than strange, remarkable, that even amongst God's people, we're not sure if we can trust him? Are you kidding me? We are unsure if we can trust him. Believe me, if anyone's trustworthiness is in question, it's not his, but mine. I'm not sure I can trust him. Oh, that heaven, the insults from humanity that heaven endures and still loves us and forgives us. You won't take your hands off of it if you don't trust him. Because it takes, what, we walk by faith and not by sight. And Paul says, I'm an under rower. The captain of the boat doesn't come down to explain to the slaves what they're doing. Listen, just to let you guys know, he doesn't share his plans. He sure doesn't go down and ask permission. We'll be okay with you guys. He doesn't do that either. He's just the captain, and the slaves, they row the boat to the beat of his drum, and they have to let him be the captain, navigate the ship. If you look at Paul's life, that was certainly characteristic of him. His whole life was a labor of total obedience and faith. When he returned to Jerusalem, he said, I'm going to Jerusalem not knowing what awaits, except that in every place I'm warned that there are trials waiting for me there. And they tried to persuade him. He said, I'm not only ready to be bound in Jerusalem, I'm ready to die there if necessary. He didn't know the path exactly that he was walking where it would lead, but he trusted the captain. And I think about that time when Jesus was in the garden and the soldiers come to get him, and Simon Peter draws a sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus. And in essence, what he's saying is, Jesus, look, you don't have to go through this. You don't have to. You are Son of God. You are blessed and highly favored. You don't have to go through this. We'll hold them off, and you get out of the back side of the garden here. And Jesus says, Simon, put up your sword. For the cup which my Father has prepared for me, shall I not drink it? And here's what you need to understand, is that in the garden, Jesus saw beyond the cup. He knew what the cup was. But he saw beyond the cup, and he recognized and trusted the hand that held it. There are many people today running around all over the place trying to cut off the ear of all opposition. You know, if you're a child of God, you'll never go through any, you don't have to deal with stuff. You don't have to go through hard times. You never have to deal with difficulties or disappointments or setbacks or failures. You know, it's all sunshine, lollipops, and roses. And you hear that all of the time. And you're a child, you are a son of God, so you don't have to go through all of this. I tell you that in many times in my life, I may have been unsure. When I saw the cup, and there was a tendency to shrink back, I may have been unsure as to what it all meant. And I don't always understand the cup, but I know the hand that holds it. And I trust the hand that holds it. And this is what an under rower does. God doesn't explain to me. He certainly doesn't ask my permission. He just says, do you trust me? Then follow me. Just follow me. And Ahuperetes trusted the captain. Let me quickly move. They had to row together. Those oars were 30 feet long, maybe. Sometimes two or three men would be chained to the same oar. So if they're not working together, they're not going anywhere. If one is pushing when the other is pulling, if one is leaning back when the other is leaning forward, probably, you know, the boat going to flounder in the water, just go around in circles. So they had to pull together. They had to work together. They had to go in sync, or progress would be impeded. They had to have a sense of community there. And they had to have a sense of shared purpose as they worked together. And listen, if you don't believe in the power of cooperation, just observe what happens to a wagon if one wheel falls off. And here's what you need to understand, is that none of us are going to make, none of us can go where God is leading us by ourselves. You can't do it. You just can't do it. You know, Moses had Joshua. Elijah had Elisha. Paul had Silas. Batman had Robin, and Rick has Bubba, right? The point is, there has to be you have to learn to connect with people, and there has to be something of network and learning to work together. Let me find it here. This is what Paul said. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I may hear that you're standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. One spirit, one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. You remember I gave you that definition of success. Remember, knowing, growing, and sowing. Growing, knowing, and sowing. It rhymes, so you should be able to remember. Knowing God, that's where it begins. Doesn't matter what else you achieve. If you don't know Him, what happens when the game is over? It all goes back in the box, right? The only thing you can keep is what you've invested in Him. The first thing is knowing God, but then the second is growing to your maximum potential. And finally, sowing seeds in the lives of other people. One of the greatest joys of my life is when God gives me an opportunity to add value to the life of someone else. And you don't need to earn PhDs from Fuller to do this. Sometimes it's just a smile. It may be a hug. It may be a pat on the back. It may be a card, a phone call. It may just be showing up at the funeral. It could be any number of things where you add value to the lives of other people. It isn't just us, you know, us four and no more. It's about community here. And then the fifth thing is that, how'd I put this? He was out of sight. Nobody could see that galley slave. Now, the captain's quite visible. And folks, that's exactly the way it should be. Let the captain be visible. Let the servants be hidden behind the cross. The church today has its own little celebrity cult. We've never had more superstars. What's sad is that some of them are outshining the sun. It's not about me. And it's not about you. It's only about Him. The slave would spend his life there in the bottom of that ship, out of sight, invisible to the outside world. And in the bottom of that vessel, men gave their very life and their breath to keep the ship going, but were never seen, never known. They rode on and on, day in, day out, invisible to and unrewarded by the world. Paul said that God had chosen the weak things of this world, that no flesh should glory in His presence. Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And what a rebuke to the superstar syndrome that is so prevalent today as people in ministry, maybe especially in ministry, clamor for attention. People are obsessed with who knows about what I'm doing. How can I get my name out there? How can I climb the ladder? Maybe they need to see if it's leaning against the right wall. There's no higher honor, there's no greater calling than to be the servant of Christ. Here's what you need to know about this. What you see in those five things. He wanted to know five things of what it means to be a huperetes, an under rower. So, because he rode to the captain's beat, he was submissive. He worked in harmony with others around him. He was sensitive, respectful. He didn't care where he labored for the captain, so he was trusting. He would die at his post, so he was committed. And all he ever wanted was for the captain to get the attention and the glory, so he was humble. And in this one little word, when he says, regard me as a servant, as a huperetes, as a slave, a galley slave, this is the portrait, the profile that he gives us. This is it. Now, I assure you that the world would laugh at this. They would scoff at this. But surely God's people will not trade a kingdom value for the cultural values of the world around us. And understand that the life, a life thus lived, is a life that is significant and worthwhile.